Welcome to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam. Hey, good guys. To see you guys.
Yeah, good to see y'all.
Good to see you. Yeah.
It is, we got a ton to cover today. This week has been just craziness in Bitcoin world, right?
Super boring. I love that Bitcoiners always get along and are always on the same page with everything. It's great.
You know what? I've sort of purposely excluded myself from all of the, I mean, I'm not super in the drama anyway, but I've kind of.
You're the wisest of us.
Definitely.
Well, I think I took a signal from Max, who's, he went like all grayscale on his phone and like all the notifs off and stuff. But I've basically been off Twitter, except unless like you send me a link, then I go click and I'm like, oh, what's this thing about? So I kind of only vaguely know, I know there's some drama going on. I don't really know about it. So what I'm hoping that we can use this time where I can learn about just from the foundation, what is going on? And then I think one of the goals that we've always tried to do when we get together is like, we don't necessarily come at it with a specific like, oh, it's got to be this way. These guys are right. These guys are wrong. It's more like, hey, let's try to understand both sides of this. Let's try to steel man the opponent and let's try to understand what it is. So I think there's just a ton to talk about there.
And before we jump in the actual debate, you brought up something very good. I think DK is definitely the wisest of us. Less time on Twitter, probably much, much better headspace overall. I have spent some time on Twitter this week, but I'm continuing to try and like only use in like, I would say clusters when I'm at the computer. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I did do, I have not followed the debate nearly as closely, so I'm also looking forward to learning from Steve, but a strategy and a shout out that I want to give is to Stacker News. For whatever reason, Stacker News never sets me off in the same way that Twitter and other social media does.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've used as my, like, I need whatever. I can spend half an hour max trying to understand this stuff, TLDR. And I thought the threads and discussions on Stacker.news were really good this week.
Yeah, so. Well, and I think the structure of that is less ego-preserving and more communal. It's like, let's get together and talk about, there's arguments and stuff, but it's not like, hey, look at me, here's what I've got to say. It's more like, hey, let's talk.
Exactly.
Like, let's get together with other people. And I think that just, that shapes the conversation a lot relative to kind of a everybody gets a voice publishing audience platform.
Yeah. Agreed.
I agree. I was really happy with the couple Stacker News links you sent.
Yeah.
Yep. And I did read those. And another reason I've been able to stay more off of the loud nonsense cacophonous stuff is that I actually found, instead of just saying I'm not going to do it, I actually find something to replace it with.
Oh.
So
what do you do? Is it, I don't know, humans to dogs?
Dogs to humans, but yeah. It's real.
I got it
deployed onto a production server this week.
You're not kidding. You're serious.
I'm not kidding. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. All right.
And I'm going to share, it's actually super fun. And I think it actually may have more of a place in the world than I expected. Just as I show it to people and they're like, this is awesome. And it's silly, but.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Can we integrate? Have you integrated with Sats so we can pay Bitcoin?
It is raw still. Okay. So I need to actually get it into production, get it into test flight, get it in people's hands. But the hope is it can have Noster and Bitcoin and like those kinds of integrations and kind of serves available, but first, most important is, do people love it? Is it awesome?
Yeah,
that's all. I don't care. Is it Bitcoin powered? I care. Is it awesome? And then we can make it Bitcoin powered once people are in love with it.
Yeah,
you need to convert from being a judge to a participant at the Presidio Bitcoin Hackathon.
You really
but now I've outed myself.
Add Bitcoin. Your,
oh yeah. Okay. Can I guess what are the rules?
Application.
What are the rules on the hackathon? Are you allowed to come with an existing project that you want to add Bitcoin to, or is that cheating? Because I've kind of outed myself because I've been talking about dog to human.
That's a good question.
I don't know what the rules are, but I think
aren't we the judges?
Yeah, I think we could be flexible.
Well, we don't set the rules.
Okay, who sets the rules?
I probably am part of the committee.
Yeah, okay.
the
board member of
I'll have to consult,
the committee. You
I'll have to consult with the rest.
Committee.
Consult with the rest of the committee. Yeah. About whether that's allowed. But my instinct is that yes, we just want to see great.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
And even if it doesn't, whatever, get judged because you're also the judge, whatever, like you should absolutely do that.
Yeah.
Well, there's no world you shouldn't do that.
I want to share it with people and show people what can be accomplished in short time frames. I think that's like an exciting thing for me. I would also say like my optimism continues to be unbridled, but I am muted by the reality of the fact that I keep having to like redo things again and again in such a way that I'm like, I might have been better off just writing the code myself in this case. I still think it's going to be a net win. And I think it's still, for me, I think it's 100 times faster in many ways. But I really find myself getting back down to like, okay, build this feature, make sure it works, then build this other incremental thing. It's not just all dreams and vibes. It's more like, you know, you're kind of grinding out building things, but you're just doing it with like so much, you know, kind of a so much superpower and ability to research that just makes it easier.
So one thing I think you should definitely do is I think DK should give some kind of presentation there at the event and just show people this is how I did this and this is how I vibe coded / dreamed and vibed, whatever you want to call it, my way to this app with Bitcoin application, with Bitcoin payments added on at the end. Even if it's not part of the hackathon, I think people would benefit from looking at your prompts, hearing you asking questions.
Let's get them on the agenda.
Happy to do that, yeah.
And while we're on the subject of the hackathon, before we jump into the cacophony, I do just want to say update on my end that was really cool this week. I don't know if we have all talked about this yet, but Max Fang and I from Lexi, we went to Berkeley this week and we gave a little discussion, chit-chat, whatever you want to call it, with the Blockchain at Berkeley Club. And it was really exciting for me. You know, it wasn't like a massive turnout. We probably like 12, 15 students came. And what was really cool to me was... Well, first of all, Max was a celebrity there. That was great because he obviously started the club. So shout out to Max for setting it all up.
Dude, 12 to 15 sounds like the right number for me. I would love to see 12 to 15 people engaging versus the masses turn out and like they're just all vaguely blockchain-y.
Exactly. You know? But here's what was really cool about it. You know, the way I like to think about this is Bitcoin has done so poorly engaging with student communities at universities like Berkeley, Stanford, wherever. At least let's use Berkeley as the example. Such a bad job. That it's the good news is it's literally impossible for us to do worse. We cannot do worse. There is no way. And so if anything goes well, and even one person gets interested, we have done substantially better, infinitely better, you might even say.
I love really low bars.
It is so low.
Easy to look good with a really low bar.
The bar is so low, it's not even there. So what happened was while we're sitting in the group, you know, I started off and I was kind of giving my little spiel on why I'm so passionate about Bitcoin, why I transitioned from the, you know, crypto stuff some years ago into this. And people were pretty receptive, but I started off by asking, you know, how many of you guys are aware of, you know, what's going on in the Bitcoin ecosystem or even had ever thought of building on Bitcoin? Zero. Then I said, okay, how many of you guys, and girls, there's actually a mix, which was also interesting and cool to see some more diversity. But how many of you use Bitcoin for anything? And I would say at most a quarter of hands went up, at most, maybe like 3 or 4 out of 12 to 15. So let's say roughly 20%. And I said, okay, what do you guys do? There's like, oh, we just buy and hold. It's our store about. Okay, great. So there's at least a couple people, but I was shocked. Let's say 75 to 80% of these kids don't even hold Bitcoin at all.
Wow.
And I know they're college students and like they don't have a ton of money yet, blah, blah, blah. But like still.
And it's a self-selected group who came to learn about a Bitcoin hackathon.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? Wow. So to me, that was just like, holy fucking hell, this is so bad. But the cool thing was by the end of my presentation, you know, it was clear one that I had, you know, a lot of thoughts on why Bitcoin. We talked about the thermodynamics of it, the energy system, all that. We talked about Nostr. They were excited about that. Then Max gave an extremely technical talk about how Lexi works. They were all fascinated. Or let's say the business kids are more interested in what I was saying and also hearing there was like money investing in the space.
Mm-hmm.
The really tech kids were really excited by Max. And the long and short of it, though, is I don't know how many apps have actually come in since then. Max stayed later than I did. But there was real interest. At least one person has emailed me since then asking a lot more follow-up questions. So even if we get one new champion on that campus and that all of a sudden starts the cascade, huge win. And I would say the hackathon is already a success just on that.
Yeah, I can give a quick update on that.
Yeah.
First of all, for people listening that aren't even aware of Hackathon, Presidio Bitcoin's hosting a hackathon May 16th, May 17th. So it's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be like 24-hour overnight at Presidio Bitcoin.
A lot of people are sleeping overnight, right?
Yep.
And is it sleeping bags or what? What was the final caller?
We'll have Presidio Bitcoin branded blankets give to people. So
yeah.
If you weren't already excited to come,
yeah,
like that puts you.
I was already
top.
Excited, but yeah.
Space is limited here, so we have room for at most 50 builders, 50. We've had a ton of applications.
Yeah.
We so far sent out 30 invites, so there's still room, and we're still looking for more super high quality applications, people that want to participate. But it's looking good. And we have people from, you know, students from Berkeley as well.
They actually signed up.
Yes.
Nice.
Including some of them timed right after you spoke.
Oh,
so,
perfect.
Thank you, Max.
You inspired people.
Yeah.
Right. Great. I'm excited. Good. Happy to hear that.
Yeah. So really excited for it. It looks like it's going to be a fantastic event.
Awesome.
Dope.
Should we get to it?
Let's get it to it.
I am coming very raw on purpose. So I would like
I'm prepared.
Okay, I know you are. You've got your notes out.
I'm itching.
I know you've been like chomping at the bit, you know, all week. I can feel it in the chat all week. Oh, like, yeah. Steve's like, I am structuring my thoughts.
I have an opinion here. We don't know.
Did you see this tweet? So we definitely want to hear from the ground up. You know, I don't even want to lay out the foundation, because all I know is there's something about core op return. There's some data drama on the thing. There's some drama. So can you just lay it out like 101 style and the basics of what is going on, why this blew up right now, what's happening, and give me a moment to like even just clarify a little bit around, sure, like what the foundation is before, because I think you're ready to go. I'm saying let's get the foundation.
Explain it like we're five.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
I think there's like many different subtopics here. We'll get to all of them, but perhaps the best place to start is the Bitcoin blockchain, is it for money or is it for data? That's, I think, at the heart of this issue, and a reason why there's so much emotion and engagement on this topic. But by the way, I'll say, even though it's like been a shit show on Twitter and stuff, I absolutely love how passionate people are about,
yeah,
Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So even when, you know, one person thinks the other person's being an idiot about topic. I just love everyone.
Dude, empathy is
everyone's enthusiasm is incredible. So, but yeah, so let's start with like money versus data and get into that. So I think everyone that knows anything about Bitcoin knows it's to transfer money. Like Bitcoin, the asset, is or can become money. I mean, you can debate about, you know, is it yet money, but it's a new form of money. You can transfer value. You can send payments to people, transactions. Everyone knows that. Data has also been stored in the Bitcoin blockchain. It started with Satoshi's Genesis block. He stored data on the blockchain. He put an English phrase in it.
Money is data, right? So the kind of data you're talking about is like non-monetary data?
Non-monetary, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if I simplify it to money versus data, I'm talking about non-monetary data.
Okay.
Yep. But then there's even, you know, breakdown of like all kinds of different types of data, right? So there's certainly, you know, I think probably a majority of Bitcoiners, or certainly many Bitcoiners, believe that Bitcoin should only be used for money, value transfer, and not for this non-monetary data, with like JPEGs being the the canonical, like,
right,
laughingstock or like thing you point at. Like, it's not supposed to be for that. But we'll get into like different types of data too. And when you get into the nuances, all of a sudden some people are like, you know, get those JPEGs out of the blockchain, are like, okay, well, that type of data is okay.
And just without knowing a lot about where this is going, when I hear, you know, I think about Bitcoin as built to make money work well in this new way. So I'm kind of like sympathetic to the idea of like, yeah, like make the money thing work well. And like, if there's other use cases, if they can be supported, fine, but you don't necessarily need to bend over backwards or create new features to support that.
Yep. And I mean, throughout this discussion, I'll try to point out my own personal view or bias,
okay,
but I'm also going to do my best to steel man everyone's, yep, views and,
great,
and
cool,
yeah, have a comprehensive discussion. But yeah, my own personal view on like, should Bitcoin be used for money versus, you know, non-monetary data? Again, it gets into the nuances of the data, but like, yeah, I'm in this for the money part. So if I could wave a magic wand and the Bitcoin blockchain's only for money, I would be for that, but we'll get into the details. And like, we don't even know. We don't think that's even possible.
And that's not because you're some greedy bastard. That's because like, it was designed
to
solve this problem around money. It wasn't really designed for generalized data storage.
Yeah. But the reality is, to the consensus rules that we've all agreed up on and use and relied on since the original Genesis block allows for data to be stored.
Yep.
And that is what the consensus rules are. We've all agreed to them. So even if we don't like some types of data that have been stored, it's permissionless and it's possible. We also, I have spoken to many engineers who say there's no known way to even prevent it if, yeah, we wanted to.
Exactly.
Like highly credible engineers. So I don't think even if we collectively decided, let's change the consensus rules to disallow data, we don't know how to do it. Because if you strip out all the existing techniques to storing data, op return, and Taproot leaves and stuff like that, and like the witness script, even just basic transactions themselves, you can always embed invisible data, invisible to other data in it. So it's impossible to do. So I think that's one of the, so a lot of this drama, my observation is there's a lot of people who haven't spent that much time on all these details, and we're going to walk through the details in the show. And one important thing to understand is we don't know how to block the data. So even if you don't like it, like there's nothing that can be done. So one interesting dynamic is that you'll see in this like civil war this week or whatever, there's that one side, you've got like the JPEG folks who literally are, you know, work at the companies that put the JPEGs in the blockchain, and they're pro JPEGs. Then you have a lot of hardcore Bitcoiners who are anti-JPEGs. They don't like the JPEGs. They don't want it on Bitcoin, but they're on the same side here because I think they both realize you can't stop it. So that's part of this discussion. But money versus data. So what is the specific issue that's being discussed this week? There's been a long running Bitcoin Core policy to in general they're called standardness rules. So Bitcoin Core is very opinionated about certain types of transactions, whether they're standard or non-standard. We've talked about this specific issue on this show before. It's super in the weeds, but it is important for all Bitcoiners to understand. There's consensus rules, and then there's Bitcoin Core policy, relay policy. This is a policy which transactions someone running Bitcoin Core will relay on to other nodes and eventually get to miners. So if you, David, if you broadcast a Bitcoin transaction that's non-standard according to Bitcoin Core, it is, highly unlikely to reach a miner and get mined. However, you can find other ways to reach that miner and get that transaction mined because it's perfectly consensus valid. And that's where products like Slipstream from Marathon, which were introduced over a year ago, they provide that service. So you can just go to their website or use their API, submit your transactions, and they'll happily pay them a fee and they'll happily mine them.
And just to be clear, when we say Bitcoin Core, I think sometimes people think of that as core developers, which are people, and then sometimes people think of it as the client called Bitcoin Core. I think you're talking about the client. Is that right?
Sort of both. I mean, Bitcoin Core contributors decided to create these policies for Bitcoin Core, the project and the software. Another thing that people sometimes get confused about is like they can conflate Bitcoin Core with being Bitcoin.
Right.
Or that Bitcoin Core, the software project and one implementation of Bitcoin equals Bitcoin. Now, there's a reason for that confusion because it dominates the network. It's like nearly every node being run on Bitcoin uses Bitcoin Core.
Do you know the actual stats? Like what percentage is non-Bitcoin Core?
And there's different ways you can measure nodes, but on the order of like 98%.
Wow.
And like back in 2018, I went out and spoke to like 40 different companies running Bitcoin at the time, and all of them ran Bitcoin Core.
Okay.
Like Coinbase and Square, et cetera. Because of that dominance, like, if Bitcoin Core changes a consensus rule, it gets merged and it gets deployed and there's not an uproar and people just upgrade like they normally do, they're going to accept that change. If they change a policy rule, then people are going to accept it unless there's an uproar and like some kind of, confrontation. So it's its own implementation. It's not Bitcoin, but it in some certain ways effectively is.
And I also want to just follow up on something else you said. If I had a transaction that was unlikely to get relayed through Bitcoin Core clients, you mentioned Marathon Slipstream product. Is that something like the Mempool Accelerator where I can pay to get it mined no matter what?
So Mempool has this. I heard last night that Antpool also has this. I mean, okay. Accelerators have existed for a long time, like 10 plus years.
It was always OTC though before, I guess.
It was more like my transaction got stuck in the mempool.
Okay.
Pay a miner or a mining pool a fee to get it unstuck and they get it mined. It became much more popular a few years ago when inscriptions and NFTs and BRC20 and all these different tokens took off on Bitcoin. That's when Mempool and Marathon introduced these products, and it was just much more popular.
But to be clear, the takeaway though is that if I'm willing to pay whatever the market rate is from these different accelerator products, I can get my block mined, even if Core doesn't relay the transaction.
Yep.
Yeah. But the market is a different market in a sense, right? It's like a one-off. Whereas if you submit it to the mempool with a fee that everybody can see, then it's kind of a decentralized but common market.
Open order book, yeah.
And if you go around and say, hey, let's just do a side deal here to get this one done, that's like open and decentralized, but not really visible necessarily to everybody.
And we're going to go a little deeper on that and shortly, because that is a key point in this whole debate. But yeah, so it's really important for people to understand consensus versus policy. And that even if you don't like, let's talk about what OP return even is. Yeah. So OP return, it's just an opcode in Bitcoin script. It's been around from the beginning. It allows you to store data in the blockchain. You have to pay, the Bitcoin standard Bitcoin transaction. You have to pay fees just like you would any other transaction, but you're not paying anyone else. You're just storing data. So you do have to pay Bitcoin fees. It does not create an unspent transaction output, a UTXO. So that's critical to understand that.
And how do you create an op return? Do you use like Electrum or Sparrow or something? You just like create an op return transaction and submit it?
I don't know like exactly which wallets give you that feature, but probably
it's like a
probably
wallet
Electrum
type thing. You just submit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so long ago, like 10, 12 years ago, this is when like colored coins started becoming popular. So very similar as today, just like a less
history repeats.
Yeah.
Rhymes,
but you know, so doing colored coins in Bitcoin, this is before there were a lot of, or really any other, or not that many other altcoins, right? And people wanted to do colored coins on Bitcoin. And then it created the debate, the same debate, money versus data. And so it was decided then by core developers to add this policy to not to eliminate OP return, but to limit how much data one could store in one Bitcoin transaction that uses OP return. I believe it's 80 bytes.
That was 10 years ago or more?
I think like 2013 era.
Okay, and around what's the profile or the composition of people who are contributors to Bitcoin Core today versus then? Is that mostly the same people, mostly different people?
Every core maintainer is different today than then.
Okay.
There are total changing some contributors then that are still contributors today. There's some contributors then who are who open PRs on Core today that aren't regular contributors. Like the PR in question was opened by Peter Todd. That's another like subtopic here. Like, who even is a core developer, right?
Yeah.
To most people who don't get into the weeds in this stuff, like Jameson Lopp's a core dev and Peter Todd's a core dev, and Jameson Lopp is like decidedly not a core dev. He's a Bitcoiner. He's technical. He's a Bitcoin developer. He knows a lot about Bitcoin Core. He's written about it. In many ways, he's an expert on it. But he's never been like a regular core contributor. And Peter Todd is more of a occasional Bitcoin Core contributor. But, you know, anyway, the debate back then was like what to do about op return. The decision was to create this policy rule. Don't relay transactions that have an OP return transaction that has more than 80 byte payload of data. And it's been that way ever since. I don't think it's changed since then. Let's get to the heart of it. Like, what's the PR in question this week? Everyone's debating. It eliminates that policy so that you can, if this PR is merged, if Core is released, and if that release of Core gets adopted, then you could create a transaction with an OP return of, you know, 150 bytes or 1,000 bytes, or I think all the way up to 100 kilobytes, which hits another standardness limit. I mean, the consensus limit is one megabyte.
Yeah, exactly.
Or actually with witness data, like 4 megabytes. Mm-hmm. But there's another standardness rule, which I believe limits one transaction to 100K. And so that would be like the new limit for OP return.
Well, I don't understand. What is that limit? Why is the limit not 1 megabyte or 4 megabytes?
I forget the reason to limit any transaction to 100K offhand, but there's some like either security or DOS attack.
Okay.
Actually, let me really quick. There's so many ways we can go here, but you know, why do these standardness rules even exist? And maybe that's what you're going to ask. But
Let me add some color on that question. Is my understanding is a lot of the opcodes got shut off very quickly because Satoshi was worried about different types of exploits. He said, just shut them off. We'll bring them back if and when they need to be. OpReturn is one of those, right?
It was not
shut off. And so do we know anything about why it was not shut off? Was it like heavily used early on or?
I guess it wasn't considered to be there was no DOS attack or security concerns with it.
Okay.
And then actually it was going to be my point on the why do these policy rules even exist? So InstaGibbs did an analysis of this a couple of years ago, the policy zoo, he called it, and then a few other core developers have written about it. But the different categories of these various policies, they fall into policies that help mitigate denial of service attacks against Bitcoin. A second category is reduce risk of security vulnerabilities. I'll get into each of these. The third is around future soft fork upgrade hooks, like ways to actually change consensus through a soft fork, preserving those, because you can create a consensus valid transaction that sort of like stampedes on top of that, and then you can't use that unused opcode in the future for a soft fork upgrade. So there's those three categories. Every policy fits into those three categories except for one, and that's the OP return. So the analysis done by some core devs for that called the OP return policy paternalistic, because it's the only one that you can argue is like Bitcoin Core telling Bitcoin users, we don't think you should do this. It's more opinionated. Where the others, like clearly from a objectively technical perspective, help mitigate DOS attacks and security attacks. Like there's not really much room for debate on those. And some of them, the great consensus cleanup, which we've talked about a little bit before as well, addresses some of those at the consensus level. But again, these policies are just at the policy level. But the one that is an outlier is the OP return. So fast forward to more recent times. I personally came of the opinion a little over a year ago, that my opinion was that Core should remove the OP return policy. And the reason, what my journey was, I learned as soon as Slipstream launched from Marathon, I immediately got concerned about this creating a potential like centralization force for Bitcoin. So I reached out to Marathon, and good on them to like take the call. I grabbed a couple of core devs. We chatted with them, and fortunately, they genuinely knew what they were doing. They had people who, because a lot of miners, I don't think, understand all these details, and I was worried about them accepting transactions that could present security or DOS attacks to the network. But they knew what they were doing, and generally had a handle on that. But then that led me to realize, why they introduced that product. And then that product became relatively popular, and a lot of non-standard transactions were being mined. Almost all of them just using OP return, getting past that. So that's when I realized this policy, while well-intentioned if you want Bitcoin to only be for money, it's ineffective. So even if that's what you want, it doesn't work. Like OP return transactions that exceed 80 bytes are being mined on the blockchain today on Bitcoin, and there's nothing you can do about it. So then I learned that it's this outlier policy among all the other policies. I feel like all the other policies, there's very strong objective technical reasons for them, but not this one. So I became an advocate for removing it over a year ago. I didn't push hard. I just sort of asked around and asked some questions. I didn't push hard, though. I didn't feel super strongly about it. But then fast forward to the past week, I think, on April 17th, there was an email from a core developer to the mailing list saying, like, this is going to change, or there's a PR for this to change in Bitcoin Core. And that's what started the uproar. And then this past week, it moved to social media. And so tons of people learned about this just recently. And I think that's one of my lessons here is that, like, I think a emotion or sentiment from a lot of people is like, this feels rushed or it feels wrong. It feels rushed. Have people thought it through? And there's, you know, and there's people that have been thinking about this for a long time. So I don't think it's rushed, but I understand why people think it's rushed. Mm-hmm. To add to that, one reason it is urgent to do it, a rationale for why Core should add this soon, is that there's a venture capital funded startup called Citrea that wants to add some data to the blockchain. It's not a JPEG. It's a zero knowledge proof that takes up more data than the 80 bytes allowed by OpReturn. So they can't use OpReturn if they want their transactions to be relayed by Bitcoin Core. So instead, they can still store this data that they need on the blockchain, but through less efficient means and means that would hurt all Bitcoiners. The way they store the data on the blockchain is to store it in UTXOs. Mm-hmm. And the way the system is designed, as I understand it, is that they'll never be spent. So UTXOs, the reason why they're important for all Bitcoin users, anyone running a Bitcoin Core node, the UTXO set gets loaded into memory. So the bigger it is, the more memory you need. So if that grows out of control, it increases your costs on your computer to run Bitcoin Core. So there's all the Bitcoin Core developers are always trying to reduce the UTXO set size.
Because a key principle of Bitcoin is you want to make the node so small that you can run it on very cheap hardware.
Yes. Right.
And that lots of people can run it. You don't need to rely on a big organization.
Yeah.
You can do it on a $100 computer or something, right?
I would argue, and I'd like to come back to this thing, I think that is the key point, actually.
Yeah. So, if this OpReturn policy were eliminated or relaxed, then Citrea could store the data with OpReturn. And like I said earlier, OpReturn, it's provably unspendable, so they don't go into the UTXO set. They don't impact the amount of RAM you need on a computer to run Bitcoin Core. So it's undeniable that it's better if this data is going to be stored, and again, no one can stop it, it's better to do it in a way that doesn't go to the UTXO set. So there's that, and they're launching their product this year, I'm told. So that's why there's some urgency to get this out. Now, that forms one narrative, which is, I mean, one thing I've seen is like a Bitcoin Core dev who's an angel investor in Citrea is pushing this through. Mm. And apparently Jameson Lopp is an angel investor in Citrea. But again, he's not a Core dev. He doesn't have the power to hit the button to merge a Core PR. He's just an advocate for this change. My understanding is an advocate for this change for the same kind of reasons I am and many others are. So I think it's FUD to say that this is a VC-funded company shoving a change through affecting all Bitcoiners, but that's a narrative that's mm-hmm. out there.
Well, two really important things to clarify on this. One, if something is an OpReturn, and I think this gets to what's the meat of the debate, you can prune that information away and not have to store it and still have a copy of every UTXO. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, the most important thing, the UTXO set, the way Bitcoin Core is designed, it has to be loaded into memory, mm-hmm. and none of the OpReturns are in that. So it's cheaper to have data that's stored on disk than in RAM. Mm-hmm. And so for a full node where you keep the full archive, you'd still keep the OpReturn data, mm-hmm. but it can just stay on disk.
Got it. Okay, so that's a very key point. Second clarifying question. When Satoshi put Chancellor on the brink of bailouts in the very first block, was that OpReturn?
I think that's in the Coinbase.
Okay, so that's in the Coinbase, right?
Yeah. That's another detail. I'll give a quick overview. I don't think we need to get in that much of the weeds, but you can store data in the Coinbase. You can store it in the witness script, and you can store it in OpReturn. And you can store it basically anywhere. I mean, any part of the transaction data, you can weave in, interleave data within that, especially like Schnorr signatures. You can do some wild stuff as well. So
one thing I just want to pause, and we want to hear the other side of this, but to me, I would reframe the debate slightly. I see it, and again, not being anywhere near as in the weeds as you are on this, but I actually don't see the debate over data, arbitrary data versus monetary data. To me, that's actually like like it's a silly and almost pointless debate, I would argue. And the idea of whether or not you want JPEGs and all this stuff, again, I kind of see that as pointless. To me, the core issue is the point you were raising. Can the common man run a full node or not? Full stop. If the common man, and by that I mean, let's say someone in an emerging market that doesn't have a lot of money with the resources that he or she has, bandwidth, storage, and compute, if they can run a full Bitcoin core node for a reasonable amount of money relative to their salary on the world, then Bitcoin has achieved its goal in my mind and awesome. If not, then game over. And the reason I feel so strongly on that is twofold. One, trying to make the distinctions between monetary information and non-monetary information is a very arbitrary and slippery slope, right? From the very first block, right? Like we're already putting non-monetary data in there. And to your point, like monetary data is just data. And like you can say, okay, well, the intention of this is to be more monetary, which I agree with. But again, it's like, well, you know, what counts as truly monetary data?
But UTXO is a core part of how Bitcoin works, and that's the thing that allows you to prevent double spending.
Yes.
You could double write an op return, but you can't double spend a UTXO. So UTXO is like the monetary data, right?
Totally. But my point is, like, one could argue that's not just a monetary data. Like, let me rephrase this in a better way. I had a podcast this week with Dhruv Bansal. It's an absolute banger. Shout out a little shelf for my podcast, Ideas from the Edge. Hopefully we'll be releasing in the next week or two. It really is an incredible, incredible conversation because Dhruv is like, I think the smartest person I know in Bitcoin. And one thing we talked about is the concept of the happy accident in technology. And this is something Kevin Kelly talks about a lot as well. You go into something, even as the creator of a technology, once you release in the world, you are not the owner of that technology. You may say, I intend for it to do X, Y, and Z things, and that's fine. And you push in that direction. But ultimately, we don't know what a technology is used for until it actually gets used. And so I would argue, and I know a lot of people have talked about this for years, that in addition to being a monetary system, in order to build a monetary system to solve the double spend problem, what Satoshi actually built was a universal clock, right? And so one can argue, well, the universal clock is the biggest use case for Bitcoin. Yes, it's critical for monetary use cases, but maybe that clock in the future becomes really important for other, you know, really critical use cases as well. And the only way to use that clock of like, this came before this, ordering things in a way that people have a global state on, is, you know, to have proof of work and all these systems. All that to say, like, I clearly, like, also want monetary first. That's, like, my bias. But I'm just saying that, to me, the key argument comes down to, and this is why I got out of the Ethereum world and all the other stuff years ago, is, you know, if you look at two curves, there's one curve, which is the rate of growth of the chain. There's another curve, which is the cost of consumer hardware, bandwidth, storage, and compute to run that node. If this gets bigger than this, if it's steeper, then the system will become centralized over time. It's a question of if, not when. So to me, coming back to your point, Steve, and again, without being in the weeds, I'm sure there's lots of things I don't know, but it comes down to if op return makes it more decentralized, if a larger op return and easier for the common man to run a full node, then that seems like a good thing to me. If bloating the chain with non-monetary data increases the cost to run a full node, that seems like a very bad thing.
I want to follow up on that in a couple of different ways. We love audience questions, though, and comments. So Thomas Roasty says, but data in the witness is cheaper. Even if you remove op return limit, it won't be used. So that's a good point.
That's a good point, yeah.
My understanding, it's generally true what is said there. There's only like...
Can we talk about op return and data in the witness?
And what the hell is the witness?
Op return is a type of transaction that's non-monetary, right? Yep. Doesn't have a UTXO. What is the witness?
The witness is where cryptographic signatures are stored. This is this concept was introduced with SegWit change. I mean, obviously, signatures have been stored in the blockchain since day one, but the witness area was introduced in SegWit. It's where signatures are stored, but it turns out like any data can be stored there. So inscriptions and the JPEGs are stored in the witness. So large amounts of data can be stored in the witness. And part of the point that Thomas is making with the SegWit change, there's a SegWit discount with data stored in the witness. And that means it's cheaper to send a it's 25% the cost for every byte stored in the witness versus a byte stored elsewhere in the transaction. There's a very logical reason for that. It actually comes back to the UTXO set, trying to reduce pressure on how big the UTXO set grows. So with SegWit, the pricing mechanism makes it more costly to create data that has to go into the UTXO set. So that's what the witness is. So the point being made by Thomas is that because you get this witness discount, it's cheaper to broadcast your transaction. You're going to tend to want to store data there. That's true for if your data is over a threshold. I believe I was told last night by a core dev that it's like 137 bytes. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain threshold. Anything under that, it's cheaper to use op return because there's a little bit of overhead with using the witness mm-hmm. data approach. So that's why these large JPEGs, videos, whatever you want to do, you use the witness to get the discount. Mm. But something like Citrea, who just wants a zero knowledge proof that they want to store, and it's something like a little over 100 bytes. So it's more than the current 80 byte limit, and it's less than this threshold, I believe. So it's these niche, that's another thing. The reason this particular issue is being completely blown out of proportion, because we're really only talking about a very niche set of use cases that would even utilize this relaxed rule. And it's also the kind of data that I think most people wouldn't be bent out of shape about. Like Citrea is not storing JPEGs on the blockchain. They're storing a zero knowledge proof on the blockchain.
One follow-up question there is an alternative approach to reduce the SegWit limit such that you could store this there?
Store what?
Oh, the Citrea, like the 100 bytes.
I don't think so, because it gets back to the kind of overhead is like fundamental Bitcoin transaction data. So I think the answer is no. Getting back to the points you're making, Max, I agree with your reframing, but I think it's important to talk about the framing that we were talking about because that's a lot of the drama. So, I don't understand why Luke Dash Jr. and people at Ocean believe so strongly in filters, or they believe strongly that you can stop this data being stored in the blockchain. And they're very pro filters. They created a mining pool called Ocean, and when they launched, they filtered out all this data. They very quickly changed course when they realized no miners wanted to use them because they don't make any money then, or they don't make...
Just to clarify, filters means there's a certain type of transaction that gets submitted to the mempool that they say they're not going to process.
They won't mine.
Which means they're making the market for transactions, the block space, less competitive.
Yeah, for themselves.
For themselves, well, for anybody
they
to
make less,
use.
Yes. Yep. They would make. They did make less money. So they had to introduce a non-filter version, and any miner using them can switch to that, which any sensible
miners are
like
most...
a non-ideological pro, I need to pay the bills miner, would turn that off. I honestly don't understand why Luke believes it's possible to filter out the data, but he does. And because he's respected by many people on Bitcoin, has a huge following. There's many reasons I think people have respect for Luke. I have respect for Luke, but I definitely don't take everything he says at face value.
Right.
He has some like wild views. Yeah. I always read his views. I love Luke, love his views. He's representative of like Bitcoiners who just are like wild and wacky, and they keep Bitcoin strong. So I do respect that, but I definitely have learned he's not always right. In fact, he's often wrong. And because he's so technical, I don't understand why he believes it's possible to stop this data being stored in the blockchain. But because of that, he's influenced many people in Bitcoin to think that we can. So then that creates narratives that like Bitcoin Core's gone rogue. They're, you know, being coerced by venture capitalists to enable JPEGs. Mm-hmm. And it's wrong for so many reasons, including the fact that the JPEGs already are on the blockchain, independent of this change. And as we just said a few minutes ago, this change literally only effectively only enable a few niche cases of data that's like between 80 bytes and like 137 bytes, which is typically going to be things like zero knowledge proofs.
What's the mechanism that is it? Taproot Wizards is the big JPEG one that everybody talks about. What's the mechanism they're using?
Inscriptions and okay. witness data.
Witness data. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Well, one other thing, just again, to add to that, I think your point about a lot of Bitcoiners, like, look, I also think that my general philosophy is zoom out, look at the big picture. Are you building a system that promotes freedom, free markets, the ability to run nodes? If so, awesome. If not, maybe time to question that. And I think it's also important to remember that Bitcoiners are awesome, particularly early Bitcoiners. But to your point, just because you're right on one thing, a lot of Bitcoiners are also pretty extreme in a lot of views. Like this whole bizarre narrative around like, oh, we only eat meat. Like that is so weird, has nothing to do with Bitcoin. And yet there's a big portion of the community that believes it. A lot of the early OGs, by the way, are vegan, which is very interesting as well. So I think it's just important to separate out. Like there's a lot of different philosophies around a lot of things that we lump together. To me, what this reminds me of a little bit, and I don't mean to be too incendiary at this, but a little bit of like the 2017 like block size debate wars. And it's kind of like the Bitcoin Cash, Bcash, and the Bitcoin Satoshi's vision that were so, no, listen, we need this and we need it right fucking now. Mm. We can't wait for this to develop over time. Therefore, you know, we're willing to do it, whatever it takes. And there was like a strong ideology. In my mind, it's kind of like, look, I said this last week, nature is going to nature. Another way of saying that is free markets are going to free market, which doesn't mean we shouldn't be grateful for people like Steve that actually put in a lot of work on this stuff. But like, I don't know, man, if it promotes free markets and more freedom, like I don't really see why anyone should care. It's like, if someone wants to pay, as long as they're paying, if someone wants to pay to store whatever in the mempool or in a transaction, it's kind of none of my business. I'm not going to do that.
I agree. There's at least three more areas I want to dive into that I think are really important.
Yeah.
So let's get to it. Because we have other exciting topics to talk about as well.
There's more happening.
We've not really gone deep on the mining centralization concern. And I think I think a lot of people don't know this or appreciate it. So let's talk about it. So,
and is that related to
the
drama? Okay.
It is definitely related to this. So I mentioned a little over a year ago, talked to Slipstream, got concerned. Here, let me play out a possible future that it would be concerning to all Bitcoiners.
Yes.
Let's say that, so Core has this policy, doesn't really relay these OP return transactions that are over 80 bytes. Let's say that there are products developed where they become popular. And that did happen the last couple of years. Then Slipstream emerges. It's a centralized, it's a company, it's a proprietary service. It's not publicly broadcasted like regular transactions. If a sufficient number of transactions only go through Slipstream that pay high fees, and that thus the only way a miner can see those transactions to mine them is to become a customer of Slipstream.
Right.
That's a problem.
They have to register. They have to apply, register. Please, Slipstream, can I be your customer? Sign their terms of service.
Yeah, yeah.
Be in the right jurisdiction globally. If they have to do that, that's an enormous
problem.
Now, why would they have to do that? They would have to do that if sufficient percentage of the revenue that they can earn comes from those special transactions.
Yep.
So if it's a negligible amount of transactions, whatever. If it grows to a material amount, and I don't know what percentage that is. Is it 0.5% of revenue, 1%, 2%, 5%? 5%, I think, absolutely for sure. Because long-term profit margins for miners goes towards zero. So, because of the cycles and stuff, it ebbs and flows to enormous margins, to the bankrupt and in between. But long-term, it will converge towards zero. So if you lose out on 5% of your potential revenue, you absolutely will not be competitive or profitable.
Right.
You'll go bankrupt. So whatever that threshold is, though, it's extremely dangerous game if miners have to do that. So small miners would just simply not be able to do that. So what do? You sign up with a larger pool to mine your blocks for you and pick the transactions. That would be your only option.
Yeah.
It's extremely centralizing. So,
I mean, that already happens though, right? There's big pools that small miners sign up to. There's just
which is a problem.
It's a huge problem.
So that anyway, another show we can get to Stratum V2 and how that can be solved in Braid Pool and different protocols, but that is a problem. I mean, the long-term vision for Bitcoiners should absolutely be that we enable anyone to be able to mine around the world.
Yes.
So that and it also piggybacks off the earlier point that Max made, which is we want to make it really cheap to run a Bitcoin node, not only just a miner, but a Bitcoin node. It you know, you want it to cost like $100 or less so that you can have like a home miner. That should be our objective. So in any case, it's very important not to have these proprietary APIs that a miner has to do or feels compelled to do just to be competitive. So that is why it's very dangerous to have non-standard transactions that become popular.
Yep.
And so if you look at the non-standard transactions that have become popular the last couple of years, it's 99% this OP return one. It's not the other. I mentioned those other categories, security like concerns, DOS concerns. Businesses aren't creating those because they aren't useful other than if you want to attack Bitcoin.
Yep.
The only useful type of transaction, and we can debate whether it's useful or not, but to some businesses and customers, it's useful, are these OP return ones.
Okay, there's a lot to go in here, and this is very interesting to me. What is, so my impression was the reason people would do these side deals or like out-of-band mining deals was because, you know, and I think this opens up the question of MEV or miner extractable value, but because, oh, like I know there's this rune thing dropping and like I want to be at the front of the line or something like that. That was my impression. But if you're saying it's majority, do you have a sense of how much of it is that versus op return? And as a follow-up on the op return piece, what the hell are they using it for?
It's both.
Yeah.
Like these different systems use different things. So runes uses one technique, and BRC20 uses a different technique, and inscriptions or ordinals use a different technique. So I don't know if I have all of them mapped out in my head, which uses what, but some of them are using op return data.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. B10C, that's his name, did analysis a little over a year ago to actually look at how much transaction fees were paid that went through this alternative route. And one thing we don't know is how much out of band Marathon was paid.
Yes.
So we don't know that, but we do know how many transactions went through Slipstream, and then also what the on-chain fee rate was paid.
Yeah.
And it definitely showed a lot of growth. So
like rough order of magnitude of the last couple of years, what is the growth rate per year? Like the percentage of total transaction.
Well, I suspect that it's gone down the last year because the NFT stuff has gone downhill. But at the time, I mean, it was, I forget the exact percentage, like something on the order of like 0.2% or something. I mean,
got it.
It was not in like a red alarm type of territory, but it's more just like if this continues to grow and it gets to a more material number, then we have a crisis. So my TLDR argument for why we should remove this policy in Bitcoin Core is like, let's not mess with that potential future. And there's no drawback to removing it. Any drawback that I've seen people raise is due to that they're not informed on all the facts. So I'm not aware of a drawback, and it avoids this potential future.
It's a compelling argument. Taking a step back even beyond that, and I like that framing a lot, like whatever avoids miner centralization is critical. What is your view on the development, not only for this case, but of all out-of-band miner transactions? Like, for example, when I first saw Mempool's accelerator project, I was like, oh, this is cool. And like for businesses, right? Like if I really need to open this Lightning channel quickly, like I'm willing to pay a high fee. Like that is an extremely useful thing. Do you think that even putting this use case aside, over time, does the existence of these accelerator-like products threaten the centralization of Bitcoin mining? And if so, what else can we be doing to make sure that doesn't happen?
It depends on how popular they become, because they've existed for like over a dozen years.
Yeah.
So they've existed a long time. They themselves have not caused harm. Number one, we can't really do anything about it. I mean, these businesses get created and they're using the Bitcoin protocol. So part of the answer is like tough luck. Yeah. It's happening.
Free market's going to free market.
But number two, well, what can we do? Well, that's why in this case where we saw some growth where it could be headed towards dangerous territory, we identified why. And it's this paternalistic, one could call it censorship by Core.
Mm.
Core software is censoring transactions that use consensus valid OP returns.
Mm.
So we're wanting to, maybe this will help some people get on board. We're removing censorship from Bitcoin Core of these particular transactions.
On the position.
We identified that as a reason for these accelerators existing. I mean, when talking to Slipstream, like, they didn't even really want this product. Like, they actually don't even have this product to, like, make money. They just want to, like, facilitate the mining.
They need to, yeah.
And they wouldn't need the product if it wasn't for this core policy.
Yeah.
Has that been, I guess with all the back and forth on Twitter, has that been presented?
I mean, I've written a couple tweets, but, you know, what, once things get out of hand, okay, on Twitter, like, people are not
evaluating that. And
I don't think so. So okay, hopefully people are watching this and we're like keeping it a little more patient and calm here.
And I just want to go back to this for a second because I think it's important. You know, the Slipstream thing I wasn't aware of. I'm sure every miner has probably some like more OTC handshake version of doing this. The reason I mentioned Mempool is because I think it's an incredible product. In fact, I think it's like, it's one of the best products in the space. It's so beautiful, easy to use. And they, for the first time, made it easy to just click a button. I don't know what their numbers are like. I mean, the fee environment's gone down, but to me, if it becomes super mainstream, which I don't blame them either, it's a great business. But that, I've gone back and forth and I don't have a strong opinion yet, but is that worrisome at scale?
It is worrisome at scale for the reasons I said earlier. Yeah. I mean, I use Slipstream as an example, but just plug in Mempool as well. Yeah. So,
could they not emerge like in a competitive environment where like Slipstream and Mempool are each doing it?
Let's always bring it back to like, we want to make sure the small miner can exist. So if there's a let's say there is competition and there's like 37 providers of this. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a small miner and I want to maximize revenue in my block, I not only have to like just run Bitcoin software and look at the mempool, but I have to sign 37 agreements, mm-hmm, global agreements. Right, right. I have to hire lawyers and like 37 countries to sign these agreements just to see all the transactions. That's a total nightmare.
Yep.
So that is not the Bitcoin we want. Like, there's there's no debate that we don't want that future.
Right, right.
So I, you know, that's why I'm not a huge fan of that part of Mempool. Again, if it's stays small scale, it's no big deal. But anything that would show growth is concerning, and we need to be asking why isn't just going through the Bitcoin network?
Why is
the public Bitcoin network?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, the only one I'm aware of where it's like, oh, we can do something about it is by removing this paternalistic policy in Bitcoin Core, which is the PR at hand. Mm-hmm. So I think we've covered mining really well. really quick. This is a bit in the weeds, but like the specific PR for Core, which Peter Todd opened, not only removes the limit, but removes the option in the software to allow someone to choose a limit.
Mm.
And so that's a nuanced thing, because the PR could also just make the default no limit, but still give users of Bitcoin Core software a command line option to re-enable the limit and choose the limit. I've looked at different views there. I think the shakeout is, even if you add that option, as we know with any software and options, very few people use the option.
Yeah, people take the default.
Yeah, always.
People take the default. So it's a small set of people who take that option, and the type of people who take the option are typically people who are really going to understand the details, and a large percentage of them will not want the limit. So very few people would actually enable the limit, and all it you don't need that many nodes to create connectivity without a limit to make sure that a transaction you broadcast reaches a miner. So there's just no stopping. So having that option is actually pointless, except for like political reasons or PR reasons. If it makes people happier, feel better about themselves, maybe it's a good idea to have it, but then it creates tech debt for the core developers to maintain that option.
But if the limit is removed, if I'm just to summarize what I heard, the limit is removed, say the limit's 80 bytes, and if the limit's removed, that becomes 100 kilobytes.
Due to another policy rule.
And there's no debate around that, I assume. That's kind of like not currently up for discussion, so it kind of removing the limit, you ended up at 100.
Yeah, I forget the rationale for that, but it falls into like the security, I think it falls into the dot.
And those all still have, that 100K has to be stored on the disk, but not in memory of the node.
Yes.
It's cheaper to have disk storage than memory storage. So presumably that would continue to be cheap to run a node.
But again, I don't know why anyone would do that, because they can store it in the witness data.
Mm-hmm.
So if they do it, then it's good for miners in the sense that they make
more money. Yeah.
Money.
Mm-hmm. But,
okay.
What else we got?
Last thing, and then we can move on to new topics. But I think we're covering this really well. Thanks for the conversation and the time. Last thing is like, when and where should discussions about this take place? Meaning there's a small group of people who've been thinking about this for like literally over a decade, and then a little bit bigger group who've been thinking about it the past year or 2 years. But the vast majority of people who are now participating in the discussion really just came onto their radar in the past week or two. So, because another part of this drama this week is that there's the PR in question on GitHub, where there's typically on a PR, there's just this technical discussion by contributors to that project on like, you know, I found a bug, or mm-hmm. can you write it a different way, or just giving, you're reviewing the code and giving feedback. And then once people agree that, yes, this code is sound and makes sense, you can hit merge, and then it gets merged. But what happened with this PR is that, like, the angry mob came, and, like, the kind of mob that happens on Twitter came into the GitHub PR, and it just makes a complete mess of the situation for trying to get your job done on that PR. So then that conversation was closed. That PR, like, discussion of that PR was closed. So then narrative started that, like, Luke got banned for commenting, but it turns out anyone was banned, even people with who have written code before on the project, such as Luke. The only people in that with that type of lock on that PR that can still comment would be maintainers, people with commit access. So there was no, like, targeted banning. I do think there was targeted, like, removal of posts that were on a, you know, that didn't meet the code of conduct for the project. Mm-hmm. But the big question here is, like, you know, what types of change in Bitcoin Core merit consensus to a broader set of people beyond core contributors? Which types of change merit at least properly informing a broader set of people beyond core contributors? I think those are all very legitimate questions. And so another sentiment I felt and heard from people is, like, this felt rushed.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't I included or part of this conversation? And where should I have this conversation? So one of my opinions is that's an area that could be improved moving forward. I think there's no question a consensus change needs very broad discussion. This was not a consensus change. It was a policy change. I do think it's a special category because most other changes to Bitcoin Core, the vast majority, are not a consensus change and not a policy change. So if you're just, like, renaming the CLI option or something, I don't think you have to go, like, reach out to the world to get approval. Right. You can just, like, if you're a core contributor, you have a few others review the code, make sure it's not going to break things, and you can merge it. So most changes can completely stay contained within the core contributor set of people. Policy, though, I think is a bit of a gray area, and because it does effectively impact everyone because of Core's dominance on the network, I think it merits broader inclusion. It's open for debate. I think the inclusion is more of informing or seeking, like, having a seeking feedback period,
mm-hmm.
and then and that should be done not on GitHub PRs. You know, where should it be done? Well, it can be done on the Bitcoin Dev mailing list, delving on social media and other places. They each have their different, like, social media is a shit show, but it's definitely the most reach. The Bitcoin Dev mailing list and delving have a little bit higher bar for, like, thoughtful posts and more technical posts and technical and more rigor in responses. But I don't know what the right answer there is, but there do need to be forums. I think that the Bitcoin Core project could have done better to inform people much sooner than April 17th this change was going to happen. And giving people more of a time to learn, frankly. Even if I think generally all the decisions being made here are right and correct, objectively so, like, giving more people time to digest it, learn, come to that same conclusion themselves, and then not become so emotional over it.
So I this brings up two broader points, which I think are very important for me. Number one, even though the more I learn about this, the more I sympathize with your view on Opportern specifically, one area that I would definitely agree with the other side of this is I would be super pissed if I felt like I was, like, silenced on a PR. I get practically why that is. You can't just have, like, the whole freaking mob when you're trying to make decisions. To me, though, this gets to a much deeper point, which is why the hell are we still hosting Bitcoin Core on GitHub? And, oh, I don't know, guys, like, any protocols we know of that might allow for everyone to have a public-private key identity, a free market of relays, and the ability for everyone to choose their own algorithm on which comments they get to see so that no one is censoring the other people?
Hole punch? Oh, Noster. Yeah. Oh, okay, that too.
With
yeah.
G.
Gnoster.
Gnoster.
Did you fork Gnoster?
No, I'm actually quite pissed because I wanted to register this. Someone already bought that domain name, but this is, I may launch a little product at some point called Gnoster for Gnosis, but that's a separate rabbit hole. But anyways, but this is my point. Like, I think censorship sucks, period. I think everyone should have the right to view what they want to view. And I think it's crazy that it's 2025 and we're still having all these debates on centralized forums and that. And this is why Jack put up that first bounty. Where the hell is our decentralized GitHub clone on Noster? That to me is the real question.
Yep.
I haven't checked comments for a while. Let's quickly look at those before we move on. So YouTube comments were disabled. I'm not aware of that, so I can't really say anything about it. I'm not familiar with it. Okay.
Please ignore that. Would they allow 8 billion people using the network? Opening 8 billion channels requires more than a year. I guess, I don't know enough about
There's questions about Citrea, which is a roll-up. I don't know enough to have intelligence.
I don't know much. I can't answer the question. But Citrea is a BitVM implementation. So it's a zero-knowledge proof roll-up sidechain. You can do stuff on that sidechain and then post it back to Bitcoin.
And so they're well-funded, like Founders Fund led the round. It's a real company.
There's several different startups that are funded to do BitVM sidechains. It's an experiment. If successful, it probably will create a bunch of tokens and shit coins that a lot of people won't like, but maybe there's useful things that are built on top of it too.
Yeah,
cool.
TBD.
I know we're converging and trying to finish this off. We know that we don't know where these conversations should be held, but do we have, just as a final point, what's the next step, or how does the next, like, what, how do we make progress, or is there some date by which this may get closure?
Well, that specific PR, if there wasn't the uproar, speaking to a few core devs last night, actually, it has enough acts and review to be merged. So under normal circumstances, it would be merged and go into the next release of core, which I believe would be the one for the fall. Is that going to happen now? I don't know.
Okay, so this dust up may just cause it to be more on ice for a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I don't know of a good objective reason to not merge it, though. The only twist, you know, there could be an alternative, and I believe someone did create an alternative PR which removes the default but keeps the option. And I talked about that earlier, why it's only really valuable for political points or whatever, but maybe that's needed to pacify people.
Yeah. One other major question. What is your opinion on the health of the network with Core having that much of a dominance, 98% of nodes first in the first place? Now, I understand this tends to happen in most software systems. However, in the Lightning Network, right, it's not that way. We have LND, LDK, CLN, Async. Do you think, is this a, you know, even whether or not I agree with like the knots people that are trying to specifically filter on this, do you think this could be a good, I don't know, pause moment for there to be at least an implementation that gets to a few single digit percentage points so it's not entirely core?
I think it's a great topic. It's a half hour topic. So let's save it for another show. Just because I know we have, because I really want to talk about that. Actually.
It's a very important one.
It's a very important one. So let's definitely talk about it maybe next week or soon. But it's giving in a one sentence answer doesn't do it justice.
Okay.
And I know we've got some other exciting stuff.
And it's a half hour topic, but we only got like 20 minutes left. So we got two topics in the 20 minutes. So let's do
Epic first.
Okay. Epic versus Apple. So a friend of mine did send me a link and I read about I think it was a judge who said that this, you know, there's always been this tussle between Apple and Epic. Epic Games is the maker of Fortnite. They, I think a while back, they pulled the app out of the App Store because they didn't want to pay the Apple tax, the 30%. And just, I think it was yesterday, a judge came out and said all the Apple shenanigans to capture payment from Epic and all devs now is over. So we're not going to face that shenanigans. And the shenanigans are basically, you know, Apple had these policies that you couldn't you know, if you have an in-app payment where the content is consumed as a virtual or digital good, it's consumed in the app, then you can sell people that digital content, but Apple gets a 30% rake on that. So a video game like Fortnite, everything's digital and digitally consumed. Just to make the distinction, something like Uber is not digitally consumed, so it doesn't not subject to that same kind of tax. But if it's Fortnite, everything's digitally consumed, so marginal cost is zero basically for them to serve. So Apple says we get 30% of that. And they have such a strong policy on this. You might have seen before, if you go on like, I think the Kindle app on iOS, right? So Apple versus Amazon, Apple, you know, if you try to buy a book, you open your Kindle app, you're like, oh, this is where I go to read. Can I buy a book I want? And because how controlling Apple was on the language, Amazon couldn't say, go to the web to buy this, because that would violate, like Apple has control over that language. They won't approve the app. They won't serve it in the App Store. So Amazon used to use this language like, you can't do that here. Good luck. Maybe other places. Like, I forget the specific thing, but it was very non-descriptive of why it didn't work or what else you should do to mitigate that. And so if you kind of know your way around, you can go to Amazon.com, buy your book, and it'll get into your Kindle, but the app developer can't point you to a website where you get to avoid that 30% tax. So the judge's ruling, I think, from what I saw, had like these two components to it. One is, you can have alternative payment mechanisms on the web, and Apple can't like limit your ability to direct people to use those alternative payment systems. Now, I think that's generally good for like the internet and freedom and entrepreneurship and innovation, but I also think it's really good for Bitcoin because Bitcoin's an alternative payment mechanism, and it's something where you could say like, hey, here's an app, and now I can accept. I mean, this hasn't really been prosecuted. The Epic thing is the one that's been prosecuted, but it kind of opens the door, at least, to the possibility that I could imagine you could accept Bitcoin payments and you could direct people to websites where you could accept Bitcoin payments, and Apple kind of can't really probably do that much about it.
Well, I don't understand it. In app, though, for example, for like Nostr apps like Primal or Domus, does this mean that they can onboard users with Apple Pay and not have to pay the tax to buy the Bitcoin you're using for zapping?
No, I think if you're choosing to use Apple Pay, Apple Pay has captured the credit card and they've earned the right to charge you the 30%.
Got it.
In their mind. It's just that, you know, like early on when Domus first launched, I think they got denied from the App Store because of the zaps at the note level.
Yes.
So you could receive zaps at the profile level, which is just like, hey, it's a nice tip for Steve because he's a cool guy. But if you zap at the note level, then you're saying, I like this piece of content. I'm kind of like buying this piece of content.
That's it's serious.
So does Primal currently pay 30% of Zap revenue to Apple?
No.
I don't think they do.
Why don't they do if you buy the Bitcoin with Apple Pay?
Yes.
That's the key.
It's the exchange revenue, the USD to Bitcoin exchange revenue. But if I have Bitcoin I got somewhere else, I bring it on Primal and I send it to you.
What's the potential benefit or unlock then for Bitcoin with this new ruling?
Well, you could imagine, I mean, I'm just riffing, but you could imagine that, you know, Primal says, hey, buy some Bitcoin here with Apple Pay or go to our website, primal.net, and buy Bitcoin cheaper.
Yeah.
So today, if I buy Bitcoin through Primal, Apple gets 30%.
Yes.
I haven't done it recently, but I think that's the case.
So does that mean I'm paying 30% more for my Bitcoin?
I think correct. They have to just mark
so
it up.
Bitcoin's $100,000, I'm paying $130,000.
I think that's right.
That's right.
Which is a total garbage experience, right?
But you also have to remember, for them, most of the people they're onboarding are noobs. They don't necessarily have Bitcoin. Yeah. If you already have Bitcoin, great.
Okay.
But, anyway, but your point—
But that helps make it clear.
Yeah, yeah.
This could meaningfully make a difference for that.
Yeah.
Could you also, I wonder if this is a boon for progressive web apps— could you, in addition to just pointing to a website, be like, hey, or you download the PWA version of Primal and you save 30%?
Yeah. Or like save the PWA. You don't even need to download. You're still using old language.
Yeah,
click on this link, visit the PWA, save it to your home screen if you want, and buy there wherever you want. You know?
The other, another thing that would love to see an Apple policy change on is the use of NFC. So if you recall last fall, Donald Trump went to PubKey in New York, you know, for like a staged Bitcoin payment.
Right. That was staged?
Media opportunity. Yeah.
Man, what are you talking about?
I thought he was just wandering around the streets.
I don't know that for a fact. So, but anyway. And, you know, most people saw that, like, it failed. The payment failed, which was a major failure for Bitcoin, right? And my understanding of the technical problem was the glare of the lights, like we have here, made it so the QR code wasn't scanned, and that's what the failure was.
Yeah.
So what if we had NFC payments, right? And even if not for scenarios like that, but just what people are already used to using their iPhone or whatever, Apple Pay, it's so slick using NFC payments. Well, you can't do that with Bitcoin today. You can do it Android to Android phone. You can do it iPhone to Android. You cannot do it Android to iPhone or iPhone to iPhone. Like, the iPhone can't be the recipient.
Why?
Because it requires a certain API by in iOS that you have to seek approval from Apple. You have to apply. Two stages of application.
Gatekeepers everywhere.
So they did just introduce this this new API recently to even enable it at all, which is great news.
Yeah,
but you still have to get approval. So we do have some open source Bitcoin developers who submitted like a test, like an example app, to get the certificates to even develop on it, and they actually did get approval. So that's a good sign.
These are certificates for a third-party app developer to develop on kind of an open NFC
to open up, use the like the. I figured slave master mode or whatever the mode is to be like the card reader mode of NFC to be the receiver.
Yeah.
Cool.
They got approval for that. So the approval, the certificates to develop. So now they can build it. Now they can build an app and submit it to the app store. Hmm. That's the next gatekeeper and probably the one that is going to like fail, but cross your fingers. Hopefully it doesn't. Hopefully they get in the app store and then all of a sudden every Bitcoin wallet should submit support for this because it's quite simple. But also maybe this recent ruling is going to make Apple a little more hesitant to deny this.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think it's going to also unlock potentially new businesses in the App Store. So if you have a 30% tax in everything you do, that limits the kinds of businesses. Like businesses that wouldn't make that much money or might not make as many sales can't exist. Yeah. Whereas if you can make, you sort of only pay, I think it's, there's still some fee. Or I don't know. There's some drop-off, I guess. I guess it's probably still 30% if you're in, or I haven't checked all the details on what they're charging. But if you can send people off to a website, even though there's drop-off there, but you can still get enough conversion that you can beat the 30% tax, and then you actually might open up new product experiences, new businesses that couldn't have been built before this.
And I want to come back to the PWA thing, because I actually wonder if this is like an incredible why now for someone to build a PWA app store. There have been people that have played with this, think store.app.
Mm-hmm.
Fran's app has played with this a little bit, with not exactly PWAs, but for his Noster open source app store, which is really cool. I forget the name is leaving me now. But anyways, I wonder if this is a great, especially for the Noster ecosystem, where we already have this alternative payment network, Bitcoin and Lightning, for someone to be like, no, we're going to go all in PWA app store. In fact, put out the call. If someone wants to build a PWA app store right now, this is the why now, using Noster apps and Bitcoin Lightning payments, I'm very interested from a VC perspective. Because if I know I can go and just like, you know, download the normal app on my iPhone and I have to pay 30% more, or, you know, start saving the PWAs into the PWA app store, which is just, I guess, a folder, a fancy name for a folder, I would do it.
I had a crazy, you might think of this as dystopian, so apologies. I'm too much of a kind of curious explorer. I had an amazing new payment experience this week that I'd never had before, and those rarely happen.
You used WorldCoin?
I didn't. That's dystopian. This is less.
That's a topic we're
substantially
discussing.
Less dystopian
that's
than that.
Scary.
You guys shop at Whole Foods from time to time? You been in there? Have you ever seen that little palm scanner thing?
That's also scary.
A little dystopian, but you know, have you ever used it?
Hell no.
So it's actually challenging to check out at Whole Foods if you're trying to use your, they have like an in-store QR code thing, which is like the light problem. You have to dial up your screen thing so that it hits the scanner, doesn't work, and they use the other scanner. And then you do your NFC, you know, Apple Pay credit card thing. And the payment experience at Whole Foods is kind of crappy if you're trying to do that. And so if you opt into their dystopian system, which I did, because I'm just really curious about how this stuff would all work. You actually get your QR code tied to your credit card. You have to approve something, you know, like I'm, you know, Jeff Bezos little bitch or whatever. But but in the future, then you just that's go there, you put your palm over it and it just works. Now, I'm interested in this because not so that I can be Jeff Bezos little bitch, but it's because I think it's like a product experience. You could imagine like having a Noster key tied to a Bitcoin thing, and you could sort of pay, you know, somebody else could design a new type of terminal that can read from Noster keys and, you know, sort of turn your
biometrically.
So I'm like, I just thought it was like, it's an amazing experience. It has problems, but that kind of thing shows a way that the world could work. Now we want an open version. We want a more pluggable version, but I'd recommend at least looking at it and exploring how it is. I don't say necessarily sign up.
I will not be signing up for that. I'm surprised.
Well, in a future show, we're going to talk about like confidential computing and secure enclaves more. And I think that it's a good segue into that, into a future show.
Agreed.
Really, we got a few minutes left. Really, another quick shill about an event that we're planning for Presidio Bitcoin. I just want to like get it out there. So, you know, we talked about the hackathon a lot. That's next week. We talked last week about the design week we're going to have here in September. But another event we're planning is slated for Thursday, June 26th. Here at Presidio Bitcoin, the Quantum Bitcoin Summit.
Uh-huh. Let's go.
Quantum computing. We've talked about it on at least three episodes here. It's a narrative that's growing, a concern that's growing. To some investors I've spoken to, it's growing to the top of their list of concerns of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So we plan to cover, you know, and like, when is Q Day going to occur? You know, I'm hearing from people it's 3 years away, 5 years away, 10, 50, never. We don't know. I have no idea. So I mean, a lot of people still hold the view that it's like total FUD and it's like 50 years away and it's just not something we should be spending cycles on right now.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm starting to spend a little bit of cycles on it, even though I don't know the answer to when Q Day is that if it is rising to the top of the charts for reasons for people to not adopt Bitcoin or to get out of Bitcoin or reduce their exposure to Bitcoin, that's bad for Bitcoin in the near term.
Yep.
So I don't think it's acceptable for Bitcoin development community and Bitcoin community in general just to be like, not our problem or not a problem, stick our head in the sand.
Yep,
I agree.
We need to look through, you know, there's several different topic areas. We don't have to solve all of them this year, I don't think, but we at least need credible answers to them. So we'll be sending out information soon, announcing what those topics are and speakers and attendees. And we already have a bunch of like awesome people who are wanting to attend.
So. Right.
And is the idea for the summit that it will be a mix of both Bitcoin developers and quantum researchers?
And possibly like investors and other stuff. But what we'll definitely do is record it and probably live stream it, but definitely record it and make it available for investors or anyone in Bitcoin who wants to learn more, they'll be able to do that.
Did you mention roughly time frame when this will be?
June 26th.
June 26th. Yeah. Okay.
Cool.
So if anyone listening is interested in this, if you know of researchers who would be great to speak at this and help teach us, please reach out. That's the biggest area we need help with because we're not super
like
connected
quantum
to
computing research.
And the tough thing there is like the people who that purport that they know a lot about quantum, they usually have a vested interest too.
Yeah. Right?
And so it's a little difficult to tease that out, but you know, we can't just like decline all of them though, because we, you know, I'm not going to teach people about
in making it more near term or making kind of the perception is more near term problematic. Mm-hmm. Is that when you say they have a vested interest, meaning?
If you're funded research at Microsoft, like you want to, let the world, you're biased towards like, we're making great progress. This is a big deal.
Right.
Not 50 years from now or never. It's a big deal in the next decade.
Yep.
You're incentivized to believe that like, again, it could be true. I don't know. Technology accelerates very quickly.
It would still be cool. I mean, I love your point on that, like follow the incentives, but having folks from Google or Microsoft or some of these companies would also be awesome.
So we'll do our best. But if anyone can help us out, we'd love to help.
Cool. We got 5 minutes.
Spark is live.
Spark is live.
So I told you guys we could spend hours talking about Spark versus Arc versus Lightning. We'll do that eventually, but like, let's just cover Spark in a few minutes to start the conversation. Spark is a new technology from the company LightSpark. And it is a way to scale payments on Bitcoin. It's also a platform in which you can create tokens, like tokens a lot of people don't like, but stable coins as well, which is more palatable to a lot of people. So with Spark, Spark facilitates Bitcoin payments and stable coins. It addresses several drawbacks of Lightning. It introduces some drawbacks itself. There's still no silver bullet. But in my opinion, it is a good set of trade-offs. Like I think Spark stands a good chance to get adopted broadly. My own perspective and what Spiral's working on is we're now thinking, or not thinking about, we're thinking about, and we are building what we call a graduated wallet, which combines Lightning with other technologies like Spark. So you can fuse those two together so you get sort of the best of both worlds versus accepting the drawbacks of Lightning or Spark. What are the benefits to Spark? It scales much better to more users than Lightning does, because you can, with one on-chain transaction and one UTXO, you can distribute that over many users. Mm-hmm. And so you just get better economics that way. There's also no inbound liquidity issue that Lightning presents. So that improves both UX and economics. In the Lightning world, we've improved the UX. Like if you use Phoenix, you don't have to like wait around or go seek another peer to get inbound liquidity. It just works out of the box. So we have developed Lightning technology to a point where it's just an economic question, but Spark does deliver better economics to the user on like a per payment basis. That's a big win, right? And it's also a relatively simple API approaching, or basic. I expected this year to be Stripe-like dev UX, nice, where you can just plug it in. Mm-hmm. They're going to, you know, they're a partner at the hackathon, a sponsor.
I'm excited for that.
They'll be here along with Albi and Lexi, some Lightning-only solutions. So it's going to be great to see all that in action. But the dev UX should be tremendously better. So that's exciting. And then for stablecoins, they're promoting as a stablecoin platform as well, in competition with Taproot Assets from Lightning Labs. And, I think there's going to be increased tension between those mm-hmm. companies and their marketing, and they're going to compete against each other, but competing against Tron and Ethereum and Solana and Base from Coinbase and all these other platforms for stable coins. There's just tremendous competition from these technology platforms. Spark has entered the market there.
Do you think that Spark is going to mostly like spearhead with stable coins and then there's going to be all kinds of other use cases, or is stable coins just one of many things that will probably happen out of the box?
I've seen data point. I mean, LightSpark is aggressively approaching every Bitcoin wallet. I don't literally know every, but I mean, I think they're approaching every Bitcoin wallet, every stablecoin wallet, every crypto wallet. They already, are doing lots of sales and biz dev to traditional financial companies, banks, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, they're well-funded. Mm-hmm. They have a strong executive team and a sales team. Like, mm-hmm. I think they're attacking on all fronts, and they are building Lightning infrastructure that they want to be used as the rails between all this stuff. So they, everything I've seen from LightSpark, they are staying true to like Bitcoin as a core and Lightning, and that is where they'd make money. They hit dev and user UX issues with Lightning to every individual. That's why they developed Spark. Mm-hmm. And they're supporting stable coins because they're massively growing as well. But I think that's their vision and their plan.
And supporting stable coins, you mean to help people launch new stable coins, not to do interchange with existing stable coins? Or
I'm not aware of them announcing which issuers are on their platform, if they're going to issue one. So I don't think that's announced yet. So mm-hmm. unclear if we're going to see Tether on Spark, whether we're going to see USDC, whether they issue their own. There's a new one from PayPal has one as well. I think like Anchorage and Robinhood and a few other companies combined to form one. So
yeah,
I don't know. So, disclosure,
I am an investor in Lightspark. I'm very excited about all this. I don't think any of this is like insider or secret info though, but their position, I believe they've expressed publicly as well, is that there's going to be a long tail of stable coins, like a huge diversity of a lot of different people and competing there. I think they want to be able to enable that long tail market. Just to be fair though, even though I'm also very excited and obviously want them to do well, you talked about the benefits. It may be just worth mentioning briefly, what's the trade-off?
Yeah. Because, I mean, if that's all you hear, it's like...
It sounds awesome, and it is awesome.
Lightning is dead. Citrea can go away, and like, you know, Arc and Cashew and Fedmint can just go... No. Each of these systems presents pros and cons. So what are the drawbacks to Spark? One, it's based on state change technology. And, you know, we can go deeper into that some other time. But what it means to the... It's a different trust model. So with state chains... you do an on-chain Bitcoin transaction, then you have a state coin. And then like, if I hold the state coin, I can buy something from Max, give him the state coin. I get whatever he sold to me. Now he has the state coin. Is it trustless? Like, is Max confident he has the money and can't be rug pulled? For the most part. But I, as the previous owner, can collude with these state chain operator, mm-hmm. and in the case of Spark, the Spark operator. So there is a server involved, and if the state chain operator colludes with the previous owner, they can literally steal the money. Max isn't unaware of it and can't do anything about it. So it's not as trust minimized as on-chain Bitcoin or Lightning. So that's a very clear difference. Now, has Spark taken mitigations to reduce the risk of that? Yes. They delete keys from their server, which are necessary for that collusion. Hmm. So they claim to delete the keys. I believe they delete the keys. They have no incentive to like lie about that. They have all the incentive in the world to properly delete the keys.
Right.
So, you know, I believe they delete the keys. And if they do delete the keys, then that theft is not possible. That's great. So practically speaking, like the happy path, you can't steal the money. So this actually has really nice trade-offs in that world. However, what if a North Korean hacker hacks into their server unbeknownst to them,
right,
and changes the code to keep the keys unbeknownst to them,
right,
and then there's a window of time and all the coins that are transferred there and can be stolen by that North Korean hacker?
So I just had a light bulb moment go off. This is much longer conversation for the future. You mentioned we're going to do a whole deep dive on confidential compute and secure enclaves, which I'm becoming obsessed with. Couldn't that solve this? Couldn't you prove the server is running a Spark, but within the server is a secure enclave? The key was generated within the secure enclave. We never saw it, and it's never been extracted.
So I think the short answer is yes, but it doesn't solve it. It increases the cost.
Yes.
Because like, you can pay enough money to break Intel SGX. You can pay enough money. You can break these confidential computing things.
But they'll get better over time. They'll keep improving. Yep. Yeah.
So it's good technology. We'll go deeper. It's good technology. Raising the cost of attacks is a very good thing to do, right?
Yes.
But it's not. It doesn't like no one can prove you deleted a key. There's no such thing as a proof of deletion.
But you can prove you never extracted the key. And what I'm saying is there a way?
No,
that,
because you can attack the computer.
Okay. Well, we'll go deeper on that. But the other thing I think is just really important to emphasize is also no one is ever arguing this is a replacement for Lightning or Bitcoin. But to your point with the graduated wallet approach, the idea is maybe does this make sense for a new user until they get to $50 or enough to actually get a channel?
So there's been lots of problems with trying to use Lightning for individual users over time. Many of those problems have been fixed. Many are being fixed. But one that will never be fixed is low balances. Like someone who's receiving a tiny amount of Bitcoin as their first experience, no one's going to open a Lightning channel to them because it's economically too costly.
Yeah.
But it could be received in Spark. And then up to a certain threshold of balance, it just stays in Spark. And once you have enough money in your balance, then a Lightning channel under the hood, unbeknownst to the user, can get created. So the user only sees one balance. They send and receive Bitcoin. That's all they see. And once it moves to the Lightning channel, they have a much more trustless, secure environment.
I also think we should give just a quick shout out. Austin's been making a lot of comments in the chat, including that he worked at Amazon when they developed DK's dystopian technology. So he saw that live. To you, Steve, he's asking, he can't find anything about graduated wallet. Win wallet, sir.
That's a great question. I talk about it. We don't have anything. It's still because we're offering alpha on this show. So it's unannounced. This is like confidential spiral work that we're announcing on the show. But because we're an open source org and I'm the boss, I got to talk about it here. But we don't have official information yet. We did just hire Ben Carman, and he's working on this project. So he's a phenomenal developer. He's working on this project. Matt Carallo did a hack week a month ago using Spark and LDK and already proved it works together. So it's in development. Expect to hear more, you know, in the coming months on that activity. And we're already in touch with many existing LDK wallet developers and people who have been a little hesitant to adopt Lightning.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of excitement about this graduated wallet concept.
Sweet.
Yep. Cool. We are over time, so we should wrap soon. But you did also mention another piece of alpha that you were going to reveal.
This the DC?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Drop it, baby.
So,
alpha.
So before we actually wrap it, we want to hear what's
well,
rumored.
I mean, one really cool thing about Presidio Bitcoin is that people want to come here. So when people are in town, they stroll through here. And so we had someone who spends most of his time on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C.
Cool.
And I just got an update on a really important topic for spending Bitcoin. You know, there's software improvements and design and all kinds of different use case development. But even if the software works great today in America, if you spend Bitcoin, you buy a coffee or whatever, and you spend $5, you have to pay capital gains taxes,
which is insane,
on that payment, right? So which is at minimum a massive burden that no one wants to take on. Especially if you're doing micropayments. I mean, you could literally have thousands or millions of payments in a year that you have to reconcile against your cost basis on every micropayment.
Yeah. So dumb.
It's completely ridiculous, right? So that, you know, there might be some people who will just disregard that and spend Bitcoin anyway, but for the masses to spend Bitcoin, this is going to be a massive limiter. So there's been, you know, bills floated the past few years to have at least for 3 years, like a de minimis. Like if you spend up to $200 or $600 or some amount of money on a payment that you don't have to pay capital gains taxes on that. And the person I spoke with think is quite optimistic that it's going to actually happen this year.
That's awesome.
It can be part of the reconciliation process for the federal budget, which I learned. I'm not an expert at government, but I learned that when you control all three bodies, like the administration, the Senate, and the House, which is what Republicans currently control, it makes the reconciliation process realistic and feasible. And so this doesn't even require like a sort of a standard pass through, like through Congress, I don't think, but as long as it like meets the budget needs. So they need to like counter it somehow, what the expected cost of this would be. I mean, I think you can just use like funny math to do this, but who knows if it's going to happen or even who even really cares what the mechanism is. But there is optimism that by the end of this year or even by the end of the summer, we could see that. So if you combine like what we're going to demonstrate at the hackathon in a couple of weeks, where builders can have Stripe dev UX like experiences, build applications in 24 hours to have Bitcoin payments. And you combine that with regulatory improvements so that people can spend Bitcoin without the tax stress, then and then combine that like with AI payments, I think it's exciting. 2025 is a very exciting year.
It's a big year.
And just to make sure I understand, I think you'd mentioned there was maybe a discussion of a limit of 200 at one point, and now did I hear 600 maybe?
Yeah, I think the exact amount is still being negotiated and stuff, but in my opinion, 600 is a lot better than 200, not just because it's a bigger number, but, you know, if you just think, I mean, with inflation,
and it's payment.
Per payment. So there's, and I think there's some rules in there
I'm not going to make you five loophole. Payments to, yeah.
Yeah, 10,000 I mean, payments.
So
right
your, well, your entire stack, you can't just like set up a script to like spend
But it's
it
not
all.
Annually. It's not 600 a year.
It's per payment.
Yeah. Per payment, yeah.
But there's, you know, if you think about like with inflation, like I've literally had DoorDash orders that have been over $200, right?
Damn.
I was really hungry.
Are you serious?
It was for more than one person.
I know you work out a lot.
I've seen it. It's all dessert.
Anyway, but yeah, I mean, 600 would be a much more feasible threshold than 200.
And I think this, like, I would not sleep on this. Like, I've been working with lightning companies for years now. This has been a huge issue people have been banging their head up against for many years. I think this enables, you know, micropayments online for stuff like Nostr, AI payments, maybe one day, I don't know, a certain company that rhymes with Doc, turning on payments on their terminals, but also products like potentially like topping up. I don't know if this would fall in there, but if you wanted to do something like, in addition to stable coins, stable sats, which require lots of, like, you know, the ability to move lightning in and out of a position quickly. I don't know if that would qualify or not. Broader point is, I think this opens up a lot of new business models, and I would put this on my like wish list as one of the top three things to enable Bitcoin payments.
So, and we may hear a result as soon as the summer.
Yep.
We'll stay tuned for that.
Sick.
Before we wrap, Austin asked the question, which we'll address on a new show, but like, what are the drawbacks to the build on Spark approach? I mean, I mentioned one, but there's several others as well. And I say that as someone who's like quite bullish on Spark. Like, I'm overall net a fan, but on a future show, I'll go into a lot more detail on that analysis. And then Arc is another technology. And I've learned there's five versions of Arc. So we can cover each of those versions and Spark and Lightning.
And eCash too.
And eCash too. And compare all of them. So we'll try to make that accessible to people.
Cool. I love it.
All right.
Beautiful. Let's do it.
Till next time.
All right.